This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is crime novelist George V. Higgins. His first novel, The Friends of Eddie Coyle, was a bestseller in 1972. Newsweek book critic Walter Clemens described Higgins' books as intricate, hard-bitten novels. Clemens wrote, quote, "Higgins sets his crooks talking, and the reader's job is to puzzle out what these affable, loquacious liars are up to." Imposters, his 13th novel in 14 years, is characteristically nasty and complicated and uncharacteristically sexy, unquote. Higgins' previous work as a journalist and lawyer provided the opportunity for him to observe criminals before writing novels about them. He covered crime and other beats for dailies and the Associated Press. Then he attended law school and later worked in the Massachusetts Attorney General's office, where he helped establish an organized crime division. Higgins' novels include Kogan's Trade, A City on a Hill, Kennedy for the Defense, and his latest, Imposters, which is published by Henry Holt. He's also currently a television critic for the Wall Street Journal. George V. Higgins told me how his work as a reporter helped him as a novelist.
It opened my eyes to a lot of things, and Jacques Barzun said a long time ago that the reason for clichés, long duration, is because they are true. And the cliché, of course, about the newspaper business is you meet such interesting people, and that's true. Many of them who are so interesting at the time that you meet them are actually quite ordinary people, but you see, you catch them at either the peak or the trough of their emotions because something completely out of character, out of their characters, has just happened to them, or they've just done something like that. So you see human beings under extreme stress, just indicted, just convicted, just acquitted, and it sharpens your wits if you're paying attention.
You have, and you've been praised by many critics for having this incredible ear for dialogue.
That comes.
Do you think that you got that at all as a reporter and listening to people and having to actually capture what they were saying? And this was probably before journalists were using tape recorders to write it down. So you had to really hear it and maintain that in your head.
The quotes make the story. That's basic to the newspaper business. At least it was basic then, and I was so instructed by my editors. Get the quotes. Get the direct, exact quotes. I became fairly expert at memorizing the quotes, even if I couldn't keep up with them in my makeshift shorthand. There's a story that I've told before, but I like it, so I'll tell it again. When I was on the Associated Press night desk one night in Boston, the transatlantic single-handed yacht race had just ended, and Sir Francis Chichester in Gypsy Moth had not won. But nevertheless, he was a great figure in yachting and consequently had to be interviewed. Well, he had arrived in Edgartown on Martha's Vineyard in the afternoon and had directly and in no uncertain terms denied interviews by the press. I therefore came in at 9:30 at night, whenever it was, with a note on my desk to get an interview with Chichester, and I, of course, knew what to expect since he'd already told everybody else where they could go and what they could do with it once they got there. Well, I reached him at the home where he was staying in Edgartown, and by then he'd had a lobster and I think most of a bumper of champagne, as he called it. And I said, "Well, Sir Francis, how are you feeling?" And he said, "My bum is sore." And I printed it. And this was in 1964, I think it was, 1963, if not 64. And you weren't allowed to put that on the Associated Press general wire in those days. But since the story was late, it moved, as we said in those days, on the A wire without New York ever seeing it. And all perdition broke loose on the general desk when that thing appeared. But it ran in almost every newspaper that took the AP service. Quotes make the story. Then, of course, when I became a trial lawyer, if you're going to prove your case, your witness better be saying what you expect your witness to say. And if he leaves something out, you better be ready to ask the question that will elicit the answer, the rest of the answer that you wanted. If you're going to cross-examine the other fellow's witness, you've got to listen very carefully so that you can harpoon the fellow when he makes a mistake and it comes your turn.
Yeah, I guess interviewing is really, or questioning, I should say, is really one of the great links between law and journalism.
That's why there's so much commuting between the professions. There's an awful lot of lawyers who are practicing journalists and an awful lot of practicing lawyers who used to be journalists and still dabble in it.
What did writing for newspapers and for the Associated Press do to your writing style? You had described before that you were writing novels from the time you were 15, but you were writing styles inspired by Hemingway and Faulkner and Fitzgerald
all at once.
Right. So here you were writing for newspapers where, especially at the Associated Press, there is a style that you are expected to follow.
Yes, they teach you to kiss. Keep it simple, stupid, and get it done fast, because if you write the best story that's ever been written about an airplane crash and it moves on the wire 5 minutes after UPI. UPI is the one that will get the play in the papers, and we're competing with UPI, son. They teach you the same thing at UPI.
So what did it do to your style? Did it?
It cleaned it up.
Uh-huh.
And it brought me around to the point that I hadn't learned in college, although not for lack of trying by my professor, that your style should be a window, not a mirror.
Meaning
that when the reader looks at the page and sees the words you've written on it, he should see through the words to what you want him to observe, what you have observed when you wrote those words down. He should not see you running these great furbelows and fireworks of great stylistic excess. At least, I don't think he should. There's a case that can be made for extremely stylistic writing, but not in fiction, I think.
You referred to the great crossover between journalism and law. Why did you cross over yourself?
Well, my first job with the Associated Press was opening the Springfield, Massachusetts Bureau. And I was in direct competition with an established UP Bureau. I had a geographical advantage in that I was directly across the common or the park from the courthouse. And in that summer, there was a special criminal sitting to dispose of what could be fairly called a number of organized crime cases. To compete with the opposition, I went cantering back and forth that public park between sessions of the court, filing fresh copy at every opportunity. And I watched those lawyers, and they were absolutely perfect mafia lawyers. They all dressed alike in silver silk suits. They all wore blue shirts with spread collars. They all wore black knit ties. They all wore the same kind of watches, the same kind of black loafers, and they all went to the same barber. And I watched the prosecutor, who is an uncommonly effective trial lawyer. And those guys were having more fun than I was. Here I was driving a brand new black TR4 Triumph convertible, had a job that I was my own boss. Boston never called me. I had to call them. Nobody was supervising me. I was 24 years old, or 22 at the time, actually, 23. And I was out on my own. And incredibly to me, these guys in the courtroom were having more fun than I was. I was jealous. I went to law school purely because I wanted to try cases.
So it was these mafia lawyers that
and the prosecutors.
That really inspired you?
And the prosecutors. It was the give and take. It's a combat sport. There's no question about it. You stand up in a courtroom, and I don't care which side you're on. You stand up in that courtroom, and when the minute you hit your feet, you're saying, I'm smarter than you are, and now I'm going to beat you. It's really fun.
So it's a way of having a kind of taste for blood, but keeping it
it's the last.
In kind of language and facts and evidence instead of actually putting on boxing gloves or becoming a policeman or
yes.
anything like that.
It's the last officially sanctioned blood sport because there is no blood, and that is the reason for all the elaborate courtesies and protocols and procedures in the courtroom so that the participants will not come to blows. That's the reason for it.
Well, as turned on as you might have been by that the bloodlust of the courtroom, I'm sure going to law school might have been really boring where you're actually learning about precedents and things like that. Were you interested in law school?
I was bored to my eyeballs. I can't recall 3 years passing so slowly as the three I spent in law school. I went there for but one reason, to learn evidence and procedure. Unfortunately, they don't give you a law degree for just knowing evidence and procedure. They have this quaint notion that you should know how to acquire title to wild animals, which comes under the heading of property law. And they think it would be a nice idea if you committed to memory every single provision of the Uniform Commercial Code together with the text notes provided by the late Sonia Menchikoff. They have this extremely odd idea that it's somehow useful for a trial lawyer to have a grand notion of corporate taxation, which is great if you're going to be trying corporate taxation cases, but I wasn't. So my grades were predictable. I got good grades in evidence and procedure, and I did mediocre in the other courses, and I really didn't like it. It takes a certain humility to be a student, you know, and very few newspaper men are humble.
Why didn't you drop out? I mean, you
because I desperately wanted to be a trial lawyer.
You wanted it that badly.
Mm-hmm.
So you went to law school inspired by all these mafia cases, by the give and take between the defense and the prosecution. When you got out, what kind of lawyer did you end up being?
Well, I started out as a legal assistant in the office of Massachusetts Attorney General, then Elliot Richardson. And I was drafting opinions of the Attorney General on the constitutionality of proposed statutes. Then Mr. Richardson decided that he would form, it was new to the department then, an organized crime and racketeering section. And since I had already acquired a considerable body of information, I was a natural selection for that particular division. And I loved it. I had a wonderful time. Now I could do something about these fellows and prosecute them myself. It was great.
Did you get to meet them personally?
Oh, yes. Yeah, the way you make mafia cases is by turning mafia guys into witnesses. And the way you turn them into witnesses is to hook them and then persuade them that their choice is between doing hard time and talking. The intelligent ones remain silent because that is not the choice, and they know it isn't. The choice is between doing hard time and having somebody shoot you. But there are enough dumb ones around so that we were able to make a few witnesses, and also some guys who had gotten involved with the mafia and were not subject to the death penalty. And we had the Witness Protection Act. We could change your name and relocate you. And so we were able to develop a modicum of cases. There weren't very many of them, but I probably tried 70 cases in the 3 years I was with the Attorney General's office.
Did you try to save that aspect for yourself of trying to turn someone in the mafia?
Oh, it's absolutely essential.
I mean, you do that yourself. You wouldn't assign that to someone else to do.
Well, the police would develop the witness, and they would tell him what nasty things this, I can't use that word on the air, this illegitimate Higgins was going to do to them if they didn't cooperate. And they wouldn't believe the cops. And so the cops would bring the guy into my office, and we'd have a little chat. And I would not raise my voice, and neither would he. But we would use a lot of language which would shock your maid not.
Would you wear any special kinds of clothes for a day where you knew you'd be doing that?
Oh, no. As a matter of fact, if I had any special kinds of clothes, which I didn't, prosecutors didn't make much money in those days, particularly young ones. No, the more you look like a lawyer, the better it is for the position that you're making to a hoodlum. A hoodlum doesn't want you to – he won't believe you if you sit there and try to impersonate a hoodlum because in the first place you won't be very convincing.
Okay, so the lawyer part of you is trying to clean up crime and –
No, the lawyer part of me was trying to make a deal.
Okay. What about the novelist part of you? Was that like listening for like great sentences from the mobster who you were trying to turn?
No. No, the funny part of it was Eddie Coyle's the first book I ever wrote in dialogue, or mostly in dialogue. And I didn't do that on purpose. I had written a short story, which definitely came out of stories I had heard. It was the inspiration. The story was inspired by stories I had heard. And it was called Dylan Explained That He Was Frightened. And I sent it to a friend of mine on the West Coast who knew I had been working on a novel. I was always working on a novel. That's like saying a squirrel is working on gathering nuts. That's what squirrels do. This is what I've always done. And he liked the story a lot and wrote back to me and asked if it was part of the novel. It hadn't occurred to me that that was part of the novel. I thought it was just an interesting anecdote that made a good story. So that night I went up to my study and began to see if Dylan Explained was in fact part of a novel, and it turned out to be Chapter 6 of The Friends of Eddie Coyle.
Now, what was the story?
Jackie Brown at 26 with no expression on his face said that he could get some guns. That was the first sentence, and I didn't know what it was about. I had to find out for myself, and while I was finding out, I told the story.
No, you wrote that while you were...
I had a grand jury running every day during the 6 weeks when I wrote that book, except Saturdays and Sundays and holy days of obligation.
So was there a connection? I mean, was it based
no,
on...
No, it was the grand jury investigation that I had working. I was then a federal prosecutor. The grand jury investigation was about bank fraud. But I had tried a lot of gun control cases, and I knew about gun dealings and the traffic in them.
You sound like you are really fascinated by the character, personality, and speech patterns, too, of mobsters and criminals.
I'm fascinated by the character, by the... reaction of character and diction and stress in all characters. That's what I'm doing. The reason that people in my books begin, the way they begin to show stress, I suppose I'm doing it now. The first thing to go is syntax and diction. If you read a transcript, if you think of yourself as a cultivated, educated person, and you read a transcript of the direct examination that you've conducted in the courtroom, and note all the hesitations and the pauses and the ellipses, it's really quite humiliating, but that is the way people talk, and the first thing to go is diction, the first thing. So that's how you can tell when my characters are upset, whether upset by fear or upset by sorrow or upset by exhilaration. The speech begins to crack. I didn't know that until I found that out after I'd done it. I had no conscious intention of using dialogue to delineate character until after I had done it. It just seemed like the best way to tell a story.
When your first novel, Friends of Eddie Coyle, which is a bestseller, started selling, were you still practicing law then?
I was still an assistant U.S. attorney, and I remained one for another year.
What did it do to your law career to have this high profile as a novelist?
To my career as a prosecutor, it It added only luster. To my career as a defense lawyer, it was fatal. You see, Boston is a town rich in lawyers, and I hesitate to make this statement because it may be grossly, overly modest of me. But there are an awful lot of good lawyers in Boston, and some of them are very nearly as good as I am. Some of them may even be better. And when I quit being a prosecutor and opened my own office, it was put out on the street. I strongly suspect by competitors of mine that I had quit practicing law to write full time. And I had, but I didn't know it. It took me 10 years to figure it out. I wasn't getting the clients.
No, which you weren't getting clients to defend?
That's right.
Well, no, why?
Well, partly because the mafia does not trust Irish Americans. Now, that's in Penance for Jerry Kennedy. I put that in that book that came out in 1985. But there was a recent trial in Boston, the United States versus Angiulo, in which extensive tapes of their discussions clearly established exactly what Jerry Kennedy's friend told him. The mafia believes that all the mix are cops, even when they're on the defense side. Well, that eliminated an important source of revenue for your basic criminal lawyer, which was virtually my specialty. The other problem that I had was that I had not been prominent in prosecuting drug cases, which meant that the drug importers were not interested in hiring me, figuring that I didn't have the contacts with the narcotics offices. And that's another source of lucrative income for criminal defense lawyers. Let's face it, you've got to gear yourself to your markets, and mine were missing.
Did the mafia maybe think, too, that their stories were going to end up
yes.
in your novels?
Yes. At the time, I thought that was very unfair of them because I have never used a story from a case I've tried. And I've never betrayed a confidence. If I did, I would be disbarred. And after all, the evidence wouldn't be hard to find. It would be right there on the pages of the book. I do steal traits, personality traits, character quirks, and so forth. But the characters that I write about develop themselves. Still in all, if I were a hood, I can see why, looking at it from his point of view, he would be suspicious of me. After all, how does he know? The chances are the son of a gun has never even read a book, let alone one of mine.
Well, I was thinking it might be the other way, that some of the people who you'd be defending might have actually become great fans of yours.
No, but that was the case with a couple that I prosecuted.
Really?
One of them was extremely disappointed when I assured him that I didn't know he was on the earth when I wrote about Digger Dougherty. He thought he was the model for Digger.
What about juries? Juries and judges, were they affected by your profile as a writer?
Not that I could see. Most prosecutors, if they're any good, win somewhere between 90 and 90% of their cases. And that was about what I won before I was known as a writer, and that was about what I won after I was known as a writer. As far as defense lawyers are concerned, I don't think celebrity makes any difference. As a matter of fact, I think it tends to work against your client because the jury figures if he has to hire somebody with this kind of a reputation, he must really be as guilty as hell.
Really? You think that's the way they think?
I don't know that. I've never polled a jury on it. I've often wondered if that were true.
Yeah, I wonder if juries are suspicious of a certain amount of show business, too, that can enter into it once you've really become a celebrity.
I don't think I ever was a flamboyant courtroom trial lawyer. I preferred to lie in wait and strike like a serpent, so I never made much noise in the courtroom until it seemed like the time to move.
What did you prefer, defense or prosecution?
I am told that I was a better prosecutor than I was defense, but it wasn't subjectively clear to me that that was the case. I just loved trying cases. It didn't matter to me which side I was on. I knew my chances of winning were a heck of a lot better if I were prosecuting.
My guest is novelist George V. Higgins, and his new novel is titled Imposters. Having written about the legal system and worked in it, do you think that there are obvious deficiencies?
Yes, it's part of the human condition. It goes back to original sin, I think. We have probably too many lawyers now. The lawyers that we have are too inaccessible to the middle class. If you get in trouble, whether it be civil or criminal trouble, if you have a dispute with your neighbor over a fence or a dispute with the police over a homicide, if you're poor, you will get a lawyer to defend you free. And if you're rich, you will get a lawyer that you have chosen and you will pay. But if you're middle class and your kid gets busted on a cocaine charge, it's going to ruin you for the next 2 years financially to pay the lawyer, a good lawyer, who will give that kid good representation. We have put access to the law out of the reach of the middle class.
Did you represent Gordon Liddy and
yes,
Eldridge Cleaver as their lawyers? What were the cases that you took on with them?
With Eldridge, it was after he returned to the United States to face the murder charges and the shootout with the Oakland police. Eldridge and I were unable to get along, and I was compelled to discharge him. I represented Gordon after his conviction and after his appeals, and I did no court work for him. I acted, I suppose, more as a public relations consultant. What we did was compile a list of editorial opinions from virtually every major newspaper in the United States, agreeing with my challenge to them that Gordon had been vastly mistreated by Judge John Sirica in getting 7 years on a first offense conspiracy to commit burglary, that the penalty, in other words, was unjustly disproportionate to the crime. And Robert Lipschitz, who was then counsel to President Carter, agreed with us, and President Carter commuted his sentence to time served, and he got out. He'd already done then close to 5 years, I think.
I think you'd written about Liddy that you thought that he was one of the only people involved with Watergate with the courage of their convictions.
Yes, and more than that, he's the only one I know about who never lied once. He didn't talk, but he didn't lie, and that was more than the rest of them could claim.
So you respected that?
Oh, yes. I respect Gordon to this day. It's, in a sort of sad, small way, I regret the fact that he's out because he doesn't have time enough to write me letters anymore, and he wrote very entertaining letters.
Well, you actually covered Watergate for the Atlantic magazine.
Yes, I did.
Did you cover all the hearings? Or
I started about the third day of John Dean's testimony, and I was there until the end.
Do you have, like, a take on Watergate that you could sum up?
Well, Watergate was the germinating seed that led to imposters. The imposters are people who are hypocrites. I had never seen, keep in mind now that I had been engaged in a very sort of clear-cut business when I had been a prosecutor. I left that and went to the Watergate. Things were black and white, and people were pretty much what you knew they were. I got into the Watergate, and I saw the press behaving as I had never seen the press behaving before. And I'd been a reporter for quite a while before I became a lawyer. It was a lynch mob. The air was thick with righteousness. And yet the private behavior of many of the people whom I got to know in that press corps was hypocritical and in many respects consisted of using sex as a bargaining tool, and there was hypocrisy involved. I didn't really think much about it at the time. It took me how long? Well, this is 86, and the Watergate hearings were over in 73, pretty much, the hearings themselves. So it took that long for the seed to come to fruition in my mind, but that's where I got the idea for imposters, that these people were pretending to themselves and at the same time taking these extraordinarily righteous attitudes to the activity of others.
What were some of the ways that you saw people use sex as a bargaining tool for information?
The media are a very complicated and competitive business, and one derives much of one's prestige from the publication which one represents. If you represent the Eagle Forks, Iowa Tribune, and you're making $60 a week, and by some fluke you find yourself in Washington, one thing that may cross your mind is the possibility of joining a larger organization, more influential, so that when you ask a question at a press conference, you will get an answer. And one way to do that, whether you're male or female, this is a non-sexist form of behavior, is by swapping your body for information that will get you attention. Or maybe just a direct offer of a job. I saw a good deal of that going on.
On the part of men and women?
Men and women.
Overtly, I mean, saying, like, if I do this for you, give me your...
We have a saying in Massachusetts about politics that if you can say it, don't write it down. If you can nod, don't say it. And that's the way it's gone. Certain things are understood, certain preferences will be granted, whether they be by a politician in exchange for getting what he wants or by a reporter or a broadcaster in exchange for getting what she wants.
All of your novels, or at least most of them, are set in Boston. That's where you live, and we can tell from the way you speak that's where you grew up.
You have an acute ear.
What makes that city interesting to you? Is it just that you know it intimately, or do you think it's like a perfect place to set your novels anyways?
No, I steal all the time. There's a Kipling's dedication to the Barrack Room Ballads is called When Omer Smote His Bloomin' Lyre. And the whole thrust of the short little poem is that Homer stole what he thought he needed and his audience knew he was doing it. Well, I'm stealing technique from William Faulkner. He can have his long, convoluted sentences, but he had his Yakna Potawatomi County, and I've got Boston. And I can take a tract of land between Duxbury and Plymouth where there is no tract of land and put a big town in there, which is Waterford, and that's my privilege. I also don't have to look it up in Boston, although I do look up street names and directions. It would be very humiliating to make a mistake like that. But it makes my life easier, that's all. I can concentrate on my characters and the story because I know where they are and I know what's there.
Another Boston writer whose books are very popular now is Robert Parker.
He's the only other living member of the Coca-Cola truck driver's famous writers group.
You're the other member?
I'm the second one. We have meetings with the board about every, and we always have a quorum with just the two of us present. He drove a Coke truck in Fall River and I drove a Coke truck in Brockton.
Oh, so you're friends?
Oh, sure. Yeah, we got to be friends when his first novel, The Godwolf Manuscript, was sent to me for a plug. I didn't know him from a load of goats. I thought it was a wonderful book, and I was pleased to say so. At the time, I had a column for Boston Magazine, and I wrote a column about the book. And it's Bob made good use of it. He sent it anonymously to Time Magazine and provoked a review out of Time Magazine. Very shrewd fellow. I wouldn't have thought of doing that. But I didn't know him at all. We've since become good friends.
I figured you'd either be good friends or not speak to each other because there would also be the possibility of rivalry between you.
That's silliness.
You know, that maybe regionalism means that there could be one well-known writer from a city but not two.
We have Ernest Hemingway to thank for that silliness about rivalry among writers. There's implicit in his balderdash about how he could go 10 rounds with Turgenev and all that rot is the notion that writers are engaged in a zero-sum game. For me to win, you must lose, and vice versa. And that isn't so. If I were trying to write detective stories aping Spencer, then Parker would have every reason to hate and fear me and probably to despise me because I couldn't do it anywhere near as well. But we're not competing anyway, and if we were, there'd still be room for both of us. Now, I think that's silly. I don't think, for example, to pick an icon of American literature, I don't think John Updike is competing with me because John Updike writes books that are set in New England. I can't imagine why we both can't write books.
That was crime novelist George V. Higgins, my guest on this edition of Fresh Air. His latest novel, Imposters, is published by Henry Holt. Fresh Air is a production of WHYY Radio in Philadelphia. The engineers for this edition were Joyce Lieberman and Paul Kerber. Fresh Air is edited by Maeve McGoran. Amy Sallet is the associate producer. Danny Miller and I are the producers of the show. My name's Terry Gross, and I want to thank you for listening.
This edition of Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order a cassette of this interview or for a listing of other programs available on cassette, call toll-free 800-253-0808. In Alaska and Wisconsin, call 608-263-4892. That number again for a cassette of Fresh Air is 800-253-0808. National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible in part with funds provided by Philadelphia-based Cigna Corporation, a provider of insurance and related financial services to businesses and individuals worldwide. Additional funding comes from National Public Radio member stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.